You may be seated. Our third case this morning is 2018-1144, State of Ohio versus Andre Harper. Sitting for Justice French is Judge Mary Jane Trapp from the 11th District Court of Appeals. Welcome, Judge.
Thank you.
All right, we will start with the appellant, Mr. Gilbert.
Madam Chief Justice, and may it please the court, I will be sharing 5 minutes of my time with Mr. Keller from the Attorney General's office, and I'd like to reserve 2 of my remaining 10 minutes for rebuttal. The 10th District majority held in this case that the requirement in Grimes that a sentencing entry include PRC consequences language applies retroactively because the failure to include that language results in a void sentence under Grimes. In other words, under the 10th District's approach, retroactivity results from voidness. The briefing lays out 3 paths to reverse the 10th District's judgment. The first path is a narrow path. The second path is sort of a middle of the road path. And then the last path is the broadest path. I'll start with the narrow path. The most narrow path to reverse the judgment is to hold definitively that the 10th District erred in adopting this retroactivity results from voidness approach and hold that Grimes is a new judicial ruling, and under this court's decisions in Ali versus State and other non-retroactivity holdings, Grimes does not apply retroactivity to retroactively to final cases at all. Grimes is a new judicial ruling because it is not compelled by precedent. The court mentioned that in the Grimes opinion itself in paragraph 11. And as I explained in the briefing, the consequences language requirement in Grimes is not compelled by any statute. The relevant statutes regarding the PRC sentence is 2929.14 D1 and 2. Those provisions state that the sentence shall include a mandatory or discretionary PRC term. The 0.14 does not say anything about the sentence must include consequences or any other language regarding consequences for violating PRC. Another relevant statute is 2967.28. That sentence likewise says that the sentence shall include the appropriate PRC term. 0.28 does have some language about consequences, but it says nothing about how the sentence shall include consequences. It doesn't treat consequences for violating PRC as some sort of separate component to the sentence beyond the actual PRC term itself. And then on top of all that, you have House Bill 137, which became effective in 2006, which eliminated any doubt that, at least in the General Assembly's mind, there's no requirement that an entry contain any language regarding consequences in order for the parole board to have the authority to enforce consequences. So the 10th District's approach is to treat retroactivity as resulting from voidness. And I think that approach is circular, as Judge Sadler noted in her dissent, because a sentence cannot be void under a judicial ruling or a statute or any law unless that law first applies to the case. So and logically and sequentially, the retroactivity analysis should come first, and then the court should engage in a voidness analysis. The 10th District's approach treats retroactivity and voidness as simultaneously causing each other, and I just don't think that's the proper approach.
Is this case moot, though?
It is not moot, Your Honor. I laid out in the reply brief that there is still a live controversy between the parties. In April 2018, the parole board actually sentenced Mr. Harper to a 30-day prison term for violating PRC. And as a result of that 30-day sentence, he received what is called an unfavorable final PRC release. And that's a big deal because that is a collateral consequence of his sentence that has the potential to increase the sentence for any future offense. By statute, 2929.12(d)(1), an unfavorable final PRC release is a sentencing factor that indicates a more likelihood of recidivism. So this collateral consequence has a potential to increase a sentence for a future offense. And when it comes to mootness, even a possibility of a consequence of that nature is enough to defeat any mootness claim.
So he would have to argue that because the 10th District found the sentence to be moot in a future proceeding, he would have to argue because the 10th District found the sentence to be moot that he could not have an enhanced sentence,
right?
Because it wasn't properly imposed. What would his argument be?
His argument would be that because the 10th District phrased its holding in terms of voidness, that would call into question the parole board's authority to impose that 30-day prison term. And so if Mr. Harper is charged with another felony offense and the state is seeking to rely on this unfavorable final PRC release as a sentencing factor, Mr. Harper would be able to argue that the parole board never had the authority to impose that 30-day sentence, therefore the unfavorable final PRC release is unlawful. And it all flows from the 10th District's conclusion that at least the consequences portion of the sentence was void. It's because of the court phrased its holding in terms of voidness that would call into question the legality of that unfavorable PRC release. And so this court's opinion would hopefully answer that legal question if that situation were ever to
counsel,
to
do
arise.
We even need to reach the issue of void?
No, the narrow path is to simply say Grimes is not retroactive. There is no error at all in this case, void or otherwise, and you could end your analysis right there and reverse the judgment of the Court of Appeals based on that alone.
Was it even raised at trial?
Pardon me?
A void issue. Was it raised at trial?
Not at the time of the sentencing hearing. He was perfectly notified at the sentencing hearing. Everybody agrees with that. The sentencing entry comes out in 2013. At that time, Grimes hadn't been decided yet. So there was no, at that point in 2013, the sentencing entry itself was valid. It wasn't until 2017, after Grimes gets decided and imposes this new consequences requirement, that Mr. Harper filed a motion with the trial court saying, I want release from PRC. And we argued a number of things in our memo contra. We said Grimes doesn't apply retroactively, there's no error at all. If Grimes does apply retroactively, the sentence is not void. And then we said, even if you do say that the sentence is void, the remedy is still a correction rather than a full release. The remedy is, so we won on the remedy question, but we lost on the substantive question of whether the sentence was void or not. And I should note that the remedy question is not before the court because the defense has not filed any cross appeal. But the underlying question of whether the sentence is void or not is not moot and is, I think, appropriate for decision.
Counsel, I'm having difficulty with the requested remedy from this court. You are arguing that we should reverse the 10th District's decision, correct? Mm-hmm. But isn't it really that you're looking for an affirmance of what the lower court did based on other reasons? And I guess those reasons would be Grimes not retroactive, Harper's sentence is not void, so there's no remand. Because in the underlying appeal, Harper's assignment of error to the 10th District was that the court erred in denying a motion for to vacate the PCR.
Right. I mean, I understand the 10th District phrased its ultimate judgment as affirming but remanding. And I think it's debatable whether the 10th District actually affirmed anything. I think the 10th District reversed because the trial judge granted no relief at all. The trial judge said, there's no error, Grimes is not retroactive, I'm not going to touch this judgment, the judgment is just fine. The 10th District said, no, there is something wrong with the judgment. The judgment is defective under Grimes, and it's void under Grimes, and therefore you are required, trial judge, to issue a nunk-pro-tunk entry to correct a sentence. So I do think that you would need to reverse the 10th District's judgment insofar as the court found that the sentence was void, and also and or that that Grimes applies retroactively. The middle approach, if I can just squeeze that in before I yield the balance of my time, the middle approach is to say that even if Grimes does apply retroactively in this case, the failure to include consequences language is not the type of error that would make a sentence void. It's a judicial decision that involves how the sentence was imposed. It does not result in a facially invalid sentence insofar as it includes a sanction or omits a sanction that is required by statute. And now,
would that require any kind of like non-proton, though? If so, you're just saying the consequent language doesn't need to be included under any circumstances.
It does not need to be included in cases that predate Grimes. We're not seeking to overrule Grimes.
Okay, but that's then saying the retroactivity is that. I mean, it's not retroactive. The application is not retroactive.
Right.
So that's not really, I mean, your middle ground here or your second is failure to include the consequence language wasn't required prior to Grimes.
Right.
Which is all wrapped up into that retroactivity.
And I'm saying if you do decide Grimes is retroactive and that this sentencing entry is defective under Grimes, then you have to decide, well, what type of error is that? Is this the error that makes a sentence void? Or is it an error that makes a sentence voidable that must be raised, if at all, on direct appeal? And my middle ground is to say that if you do say it was error, retroactivity and all those things, then at most this is a voidable error that Mr. Harper should have raised on direct appeal and is not subject to collateral attack after the direct appeal process.
Okay, I understand. Thanks.
Thank you.
Chief Justice, and may it please the court. If the court continues with its void sentence doctrine, the state has just offered good solutions for this case. But those solutions won't stop the next voidable case from coming, nor will they resolve the confusion in the lower courts about the doctrine. So I'd like to focus my time today on the reasons why the court should be opening to revisiting the doctrine itself. Next month is going to mark 15 years since this court's decision in Jordan. So the doctrine has had plenty of time to stabilize, but it's failed to do so. Every time this court resolves one issue, and the court has tried to limit the doctrine and clarify the doctrine, but every time the court resolves one issue, others pop up. And I think this case provides a great example of that. In Grimes, this court, I understand the instinct for a narrow solution, but in Grimes, this court tried the narrow solution. It expressly didn't address the underlying voidable implications. So you have offenders like Mr. Harper who immediately after Grimes seize on the consequences language in Grimes and try and void their post-release control. And then if you fast forward 2 years, we already have at least three different appellate approaches in Ohio about how to handle that. In the 6th District, Grimes is not retroactive. In the 10th District, Grimes is retroactive, can void a sentence, but can be corrected. In the 8th District, Grimes is retroactive, can void a sentence, but it cannot be corrected. And that's the type of confusion this doctrine is becoming. And even if it resolves confusion in this area, there's other confusion that's going to spring up. I would note that even after 15 years of the doctrine, it's unclear exactly when it applies. Some of these courts' cases suggest it is a post-release control only doctrine, but then if you look at cases like Harris, Morris, and most recently Williams, they extend it outside that context. And if you look at paragraph 22 of Williams, that reasoning is very broad. You should expect litigants anytime they can argue that a statutory mandate was violated to say, that makes my sentence void. This court in other contexts hasn't been shy about overruling its past cases. And I think two particularly helpful examples in this case are Gladys itself and this court's decision last year in State Ex Relation Klein. And why those are helpful examples is because they both involve an initial departure from a traditional rule, but then this court deciding years down the line that that departure was both wrong in the first instance and unworkable. And this case has the same hallmarks. You have what has become an unnecessarily confusing area of law, and that confusion is troubling the lower courts, it's causing frustration, and it is leading to conflicts and a multitude of follow-up issues before this court. And I think another hallmark is the odd distinctions the doctrine creates. I think one of the prime examples is that constitutional errors are only voidable. But if you commit a procedural error in imposing post-release control, that is void. And not only does that void the sentence, but if you look at a case like Billiter, that shows the extreme example of not only voids the sentence, it voids a subsequent escape conviction. And that comes from the power of the term void. This isn't just correcting an erroneous sentence like under an illegal sentence doctrine. Once you put that void label on a sentence, it is as this court said in Bezik, is as if it never occurred.
Counsel, do we typically apply Gladys to criminal matters?
I think that's still an open issue in the court, but I think we satisfy. I might be wrong on that, but that's my understanding.
Have you found cases where we've applied Gladys to criminal proceedings?
Gladys has certainly been discussed in the concurrences and the dissents in this area, so that would suggest it applies. But I, offhand, Your Honor,
both it's a concurrent and a dissent that would suggest that some people think it applied, but not the majority.
Even if it applies, Your Honor, I think we satisfy the factors, and I think that the factors show more broad reasons why the doctrine should be overruled. I want to be sensitive to the state's time on rebuttal, so I ask that we ask that you overrule the doctrine.
Thank you. Counsel.
Chief Justice O'Connor, Justices of this court, may it please the court, George Schumann on behalf of the appellee, Andre Harper. Harper tried to use Grimes to void his PRC. Specifically, Harper was under a consequence. Grimes came out, and he didn't want to have his consequence. So he tried to apply this court's precedent that a void sentence cannot be corrected once prison is completed. He was completely unsuccessful. In the trial court, he lost. He was also completely unsuccessful in the Court of Appeals. And as a result of that, I am not the typical appellee that's trying to defend the judgment of the Court of Appeals below. In fact, I have no interest in defending the Court of Appeals judgment or its rationale. My client lost. The nunk-pro-tunk that was ordered was not a remedy that he was asking for. He specifically argued against the nunk-pro-tunk in his brief. It's interesting that the state, in its appellee brief in the 10th District, actually said, at best, Harper gets a nunk-pro-tunk. That's at page 13 of the appellee brief in the 10th District. And here we are, Harper got a nunk-pro-tunk, but the state appeals to the Ohio Supreme Court. So I'm bewildered.
Okay, the state says this case isn't moot because he was found to have violated his PRC. That means that if he ever gets another PRC, something else happens, he gets another PRC violation, that he'll have a collateral consequence from that.
Your Honor.
And that he'll be able to argue that that violation wasn't properly imposed. I mean, isn't that right? Wouldn't you, as his defense attorney, make that argument if he was in that situation? Wouldn't.
No, Your Honor. Reason being is nothing that this court decides in this case will affect whether or not a trial court in the future can use the fact that Harper was unsuccessfully discharged against him to enhance a new offense.
Even if the 10th District stands and says that the PRC that was imposed on him was void, his sentence was void, and he was sentenced for that, you don't think someone would argue that again? I mean,
Your Honor, the 10th District did not say that. They said that PRC was duly imposed. If they would have said it was void, they would not have done a nunk-pro-tunk. You can't do a nunk-pro-tunk to correct a void sentence. You can only do a resentencing. But they did not order a resentencing.
No, we've said where a sentence is partially void, a nunk-pro-tunk is the way to fix it. I mean, that's pretty, that's what this court said in Fisher, right?
Your Honor, I don't know. I'm sorry. I don't agree that my understanding of the PRC law is that if the sentence was not properly imposed, then the sentence is void. It must be corrected. However,
well, what authority would the 10th District have had to remand if it wasn't void?
The authority to remand was to correct the entry pursuant to Grimes, based on their retroactive application to Grimes. And all the
But the only way it could have had authority to remand was if it was a void sentence, right? There was no direct appeal.
No, because a criminal rule 36 correction can be done at any time, and a court always has continuing jurisdiction to do a criminal rule 36 correction. And basically, Harper, you know, complained that his consequences weren't in there, but he was told duly at the sentencing hearing of the consequences. So all the Court of Appeals did was merely say, have the entry reflect what accurately and validly took place at the sentencing hearing. There's absolutely no finding of voidness in this case. And if there was, this would be a justiciable issue, perhaps, but there was no finding of voidness, so the premise of the state's second proposition of law is not supported by the facts in this case.
So, then why did the 10th District have all that discussion about voidness?
Pardon me?
Well, I mean, I read the opinion. What was all that discussion for?
No, they followed this court's precedent. The court's precedent was that if a sentence is not properly imposed, res judicata does not apply. Res judicata, pardon me, if a defendant...
Wait a second. Our precedent is if a sentence is void, res judicata doesn't apply. Otherwise, res judicata applies, right?
Your Honor, this is my answer. Res judicata is a threshold doctrine. It's applied to preclude review. This court has designated PRC sentencing error claims as a type of claim that are not subject to res judicata because they might be void and we don't want a void sentence to stand. So this court has said, Bloomer and other cases, a trial court cannot, or a court of appeals cannot, ignore the void sentence claim. So the court has to engage in the review. But by engaging in the review, it is not finding that it is void. It's just engaging in the review. That's what happened here. Pardon me. Harper engaged in the review and then found that Harper's sentence was not void. And then they ordered a nunk-pro-tunk using Grimes. You know, retroactive application of Grimes is a good idea because it gives uniformity in sentencing entries. And so, you know, that's all they did was they just made the sentencing entry reflect what this court said a minimally compliant sentencing entry should reflect.
Your client's no further ahead in his...
No finality was upset, Your Honor. He stayed on... No finality was upset in this case because he stayed on PRC, and the nunk-pro-tunk didn't upset finality because it's now for then. The nunk-pro-tunk
is set...
So
he's still susceptible to PRC at this point, or is the time expired for that?
It lapsed by the passage of time. That's why it's moot, and he doesn't want to defend. He didn't appeal.
So right now he is not under post-release control sanction. Should he violate with a... There's no probation term to violate or parole term to violate, and if he commits another felony, that's separate and apart.
Separate and apart. There is nothing this court can rule today, whether to affirm, reverse, or modify, to vacate the order for the remand for the nunk-pro-tunk, that will have any legal effect on Harper. And this appeal involves Harper's sentencing entry, and his sentencing entry has no effect.
But there could be other defendants out there similarly situated that are pre-Grimes defendants, correct?
Yes, and I would argue, Your Honor, real quick on that, is that it's a limited issue because, first of all, Grimes only applies where proper notice was given at sentencing, and therefore, these defendants can never really have a void claim. All they have is a nunk-pro-tunk, according to Harper. And the other thing is that prior to Grimes, there were already districts that had requirements under their case law that were pre-Grimes compliant. So it's very few, and the longer time passes, even less.
Counselor,
it's not a matter of public interest.
Let me ask you, as a defense attorney, do you think that we should take violations of... technical violations of PRC, of how PRC is more imposed, and violations of criminal rights or constitutional rights?
Your Honor, it's a mixing up of apples.
No, I don't think it is, right? Because, I mean, I'm just curious why, I mean, if you think it makes sense that we should say that violating someone's constitutional right does not make a sentence void, only voidable, but if a judge says the wrong words about PRC, then that makes a sentence void. Does that make any sense to you as a defense attorney?
Well, the constitutional hypothetical would be more like in a trial setting where there's a forfeiture or a waiver by the inaction of defense counsel. It's not the same thing. Here, we're talking about the court, trial court, being...
Well, if the trial court denies someone a right to a jury trial, they don't appeal from that. That doesn't make a sentence void, right?
It hasn't. That had nothing to do with his sentence. The problem with the sentence.
It had something to do with the person's conviction. That seems.
It's a broad statement. I'm no fan of forfeiture, Your Honor, as a defense attorney. But I will say that the court has made in my view, a very clear set of case law. The trial court must impose PRC as part of the sentence.
I'm just asking if you think it makes sense that we protect PRC rights more strictly than we protect constitutional rights.
That's a difficult question for me to answer. I think it makes sense that you protect PRC sentencing requirements because the defendant cares. The defendant does care.
He cares about the constitutional rights too, doesn't he?
Yeah, but when he's sentenced and the court imposed sentence and it's a loss on his liberty, he wants to know what that is and he wants it to be properly executed down the line by the executive branch where there was a proper separation of powers complied with by the trial court's proper imposition. It's just, to me, it's a difficult question to answer because I see the argument, you can waive a constitutional right, but you can't waive a PRC error, but they're in two totally different arenas. Anything else, Your Honor, on that point?
No.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Counsel, you've used your time. You may take a minute.
Thank you, Your Honor. I look at paragraph 15 of the majority opinion and also paragraph 22 of the dissenting opinion. Clearly, the 10th District majority was relying on voidness to create retroactivity. We won on the remedy question, but that does not negate the fact that there's still a finding by a court of appeals that the absence of consequences language makes at least the consequences part of the sentence void. And that calls into question the executive branch's authority to enforce consequences for PRC.
But isn't
violation.
That only if you find that Grimes is retroactive?
Well, yes and no, because this voidness holding could have applies to all cases before and after Grimes. So even applying Grimes prospectively only, as we hope that you find you do, this voidness holding means that even after Grimes, if an entry doesn't contain consequences language, that sentence is at least partially void, and without the non-pro-tunk entry, the parole authority would have no authority to enforce consequences. That's why this case is important to us, and we hope you'll either find Grimes not retroactive, or second, that Grimes error does not result in a void sentence, or third, do away with the void sentence doctrine altogether. Thank you.
Thank you. We'll take the matter under advisement. You'll be notified of our decision.